Hello, and welcome to the Creative Viz podcast, where we discuss topics in architecture, development, and urban design. Today, I'm really pleased to have Margot Utter with us on the podcast. She is a development manager with Styles Development in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Welcome, Margot. Really glad to have you on. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for having me. Excited to be here and dive deeper.
Awesome. Well, I understand you're pretty focused in the multifamily space. Can you tell us how things are going so far in 2024?
Yes, very heavy focused in multifamily. Yeah, I'm with the Styles Residential Group, but we have several different development divisions here at Styles. I think for 2024, and it's crazy that I think we're right about halfway at this point into the year. It always surprises you. It certainly hasn't been as robust of a market as we were all expecting. I feel that we hit some bumpy times in 23 and everyone was looking for 24, some relief in the interest rates and for rent growth to stay strong. It certainly hasn't been the fruitful year with light at the end of the tunnel that I think that we were expecting. I think we're very much still in the survive until 25 stage. However, there's peaks of light here and there, and still very fortunate to be working in some of the strongest multifamily market in the U.S. as well. So not the best, but staying hopeful.
I've heard that term a lot. Survive till 25. Mm-hmm. I can certainly relate. But if you can tell me some of the appeal behind multifamily and any particulars that you might be able to share with us, not just South Florida, but I understand Styles is very active throughout the Southeast.
Yes, particularly for myself, I always had such a strong interest in multifamily to begin with when I was first getting exposure to just the development world in general. You're creating a space that there's going to be an end user living in that space, and it's all about lifestyle. And you're constantly thinking, okay, how is someone going to use this space? How is someone going to live here? And I think there's just so many interesting aspects to that, not only physical, but also psychological, thinking about the different renter profiles. So there's just, to me personally, and maybe I'm a little bit nerdier about it in the sense, it's very interesting, especially to see how it evolves and to be on the forefront of lifestyle and how people live, since we have such a large renter market right now. And then going into why multifamily, why this has been such a strong asset class to begin with across the board. People always are going to need a place to live, regardless of the fact that there's that strong desire to eventually own an asset and build your equity.
Right.
You know, there's always going to be that need, and there's always going to be that class, that grouping of people that are going to be renters, essentially, that either one, don't have maybe the means to buy a house, to buy an asset, or maybe they're a little bit more transient and they want some more flexibility. And that's when the multifamily space just becomes very desirable. And right now we're obviously in a time where it couldn't be more difficult to be able to purchase a home or a townhouse, a condo, whatever it may be. And it doesn't matter whether you're a young individual like myself, somewhat recently out of school, even you're starting to see people in their mid to late 30s, it's still very challenging for housing to just be attainable. So that's where multifamily comes in. You compare the cost of what your monthly payment is if you have a mortgage, and you side by side line that up with what your monthly payment is for rent. And even if you're in a very strong urban market where rents are quote unquote high, it just still makes so much more sense to rent. And that's what creates such a strong market for us than in multifamily, and especially in the Southeast region that we're focused in.
Yeah, you're primarily developing rental properties as opposed to for sale. Is that correct?
Correct. We have in the past, if you look kind of into the Styles history, I was not personally working here at the time, but we have in the past developed condo. I believe that's how our group started way back in the day, over 10 years ago. We were condo developers. We have a few of those in our Rolodex. But as of recently, we've been more known as multifamily developers on that side of things. But the condo market and for sale property is certainly not out of the picture. It's something that I know that we're constantly circling. You're always looking for ways to maybe pivot, especially when you're in markets, right, that are just kind of what we're dealing with right now. Definitely a multifamily rental focused group, but there's that eye on the potential for condo in the horizon.
I think you touched on the difficulty with affordability. Can you tell us what opportunities there are for affordable housing development, particularly in South Florida. And you had mentioned the Live Local Act that has been helpful. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. So affordability, it's not only an issue in Florida, it's but worldwide and very talked about in many markets in the U.S. And obviously, we're talking about it in Florida. There's conversations driven by the counties across Florida and cities. You're having discussions about it being a priority since, unfortunately, we're in this time where it's not only the cost of living, it's the cost of groceries, it's the cost of just everyday life, insurance, even for individuals and businesses alike, that the cost of living is added to that list of things that make it tough to keep going day to day in a strong way. And so affordable housing is something that comes up as a developer when you're specifically going through the entitlement process. And when you're first starting off projects, there's that opportunity for local government, for council members, commissioners, the mayors to bring up that ask to developers where it's like, hey, this is a new project you're looking at. Is there any way we can add affordable housing to it? It's such a large can of worms to open up here. And I believe from the developer standpoint that it's, of course, very important. We need to be having these conversations, but it's really not just a straight road ahead. There's several factors that you have to consider when you think about it. There's a lot of areas here in South Florida specifically. There's such a demand for housing, and there's such a large influx of people that have moved here since COVID and are continuing to flood in here. That demand for housing has had rents rise at a rate that supply really can't keep up with it. So there's that whole conversation of supply and demand. And I believe we're just starting to hit that point, and specifically in our Fort Lauderdale market, where that demand is being fulfilled by the supply. We're having enough supply to fulfill the demand, and rents are stabilizing. Rents are still high to the point that even when they stabilize, it's still very unachievable for certain individuals. Then comes the Live Local Act, identifying pieces of land where a developer can get a subsidy or some sort of incentive to develop affordable, since unfortunately, it's very hard for any developer to raise their hand and be like, yep, this is going to be an affordable property, because it really hits the bottom line and it makes it even more difficult to develop. Because to be very frank, market rate projects without affordable, you can't even make those work right now. So it makes it even more difficult to add that affordable component. So there definitely has to be some collaboration when it comes to expectations of affordable housing. And another thing that we didn't mention was there are affordable developers. That's what they specialize in. That's their product type. So they specifically build a product that is an affordable product. It's cost efficient, still very nice design, but it's meant to be built at a lower cost. And typically they identify locations where land isn't quite as expensive, because all of those things add up. It's very hard to look at a developer that is entitling a premier site in a downtown urban area and be like, hey, so is this going to have a 20% affordable housing component? And it's hard to make sense of it because the land basis in those very urban areas are so high. And when you're looking at the concept of highest and best use, it just doesn't pencil. And that's why local governments and cities are banding together. They have affordable housing impact fees that they charge developers who forego affordable requirements. They make it a little bit more challenging to get through that entitlement phase without having that contribution. So it's that constant arm wrestling of trying to have the conversation with developers and provoking them to consider affordable at the same time as being the developer on the other end. It's trying to make it work and make everyone happy at the end of the day. But I will say, if you aren't one of those affordable specific developers like ourselves, we are more like a boutique developer in a sense, and we build brand new Class A products. We are much more about quality over quantity. So when you have that business model, it makes it more challenging. It certainly doesn't mean that we are completely opposed to it, because we are exploring the idea of adding it on a few of our upcoming projects. It's just going to look a little bit different than maybe working with a straight affordable developer.
Right. No, that's really interesting. So affordability from the projects that your group is working on, just to be clear, it's not like the entire project is all affordable. It has a certain percentage, maybe 20%, I think you mentioned something like that. Is that the case?
Correct. Yes. It's whatever affordable component we would add to ours, it is not going to be 100% because it's just not the product that we build. Those types of projects have to be in certain locations where it just is more economical. And typically that's more of a garden product. Affordability makes much more sense in a garden product type of development that's cheaper to build, a little bit more suburban type of product, and it just makes more sense. And we're also exploring it on some mid-rise products, which it works with some of those as well. The products where it's very difficult to make sense of affordable component is a high-rise, just because the cost there is, it just doesn't economically. But we do have an opportunity right now, and we're working with the local government as we get approvals, and we are considering adding an affordable component to give back to the city and allow for there to be a more diverse population living in our buildings, but also still delivering a nice market rate product that's going to add value to the area and it's going to link all those factors together.
No, that's fantastic. It's a passion of mine. I know housing is such a dire need, really in my world here, but all through the country. It's a difficult problem to solve. And so it's really great hearing all the different strategies that people are using. One last question on this, and I promise we'll move on. I had an interesting conversation the other day with another developer who said that in some cases, speed to market is actually quicker with affordable project or affordable component projects versus a pure market rate. A lot of that is going to be dependent on incentives that the jurisdictions are going to have. What does that look like for you with your group in South Florida?
When you describe that, are you saying the lease up being quicker or it being a little bit more successful?
Some jurisdictions are accelerating the reviews or permitting processes if there is an affordable component. And time is money more than ever. And so I'd be curious to know if you've seen anything like that in South Florida.
Yes. So I've heard of that concept, and it's something I believe that's still developing in certain municipalities. Like you said, time is money, and that's so valuable to us when it comes to these projects that at this point, they take 5 to 6 years. Unless you have a project that is ready to go and titled, they truly take a solid, I would say, 5 to 6 years, in some cases longer. So the idea of a expedited permitting period, entitlement period, is very attractive to us. We've had discussions about it in certain cities that we're actually working with, one in particular that we are pursuing a new entitlement on, and they've discussed the idea of that. The hard part is that it's very open-ended. Well, what does expedited mean? Does that mean I get something done in half the amount of time? Does that mean right. I get it done a week earlier? Because it not having that here that defined is a little bit difficult, and it's risky, because if can cut your time in half, that's great. If it maybe speeds it up a couple weeks, I feel like a couple weeks isn't enough to really move that lever there. So it all comes down to what is the city capable of doing, since in some of these cities where they have a very heavy inflow of new developments and new permits, and they only have a certain amount of staff, trying to have that conversation with the city and be like, well, are you going to maybe hire more people that work in your building department and in the industry? Are they even capable of making that process expedited to the point where it financially can help the developer or give some relief on that sense? So it's interesting, and I think it would be a great concept. It's just, I don't know if we've really seen it in action yet. Because there's such a risk and an unknown there, you want to see some of these municipalities put it in action or lay it out and be like, this is the new timeline for an affordable expedited process. But it would certainly be valuable if we can get it done. So hoping to see some more work on that soon.
Yeah, certainly. And nobody wants to be the first. You want somebody else to jump through those hoops for you. For sure.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it's already too risky what we do.
Certainty. That's all I want.
Business.
Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us. It's a really interesting topic. I did want to learn a little bit more about styles as a group. I understand some unique characteristics of how you approach development. I'd love to explore that with you. Basically, being full service, that means you have architectural staff and construction staff all integrated. Tell us how that works for you and how might that affect the development process in your world.
Yes. So Styles is known for being not only a family company, but a full service real estate company. It's so unique how we work together. And one of the reasons why I love working here. So just to give a basic rundown, we have a development and acquisitions arm. So myself, I'm involved in that development arm. Then, like you mentioned, we have construction, our, you know, GC or general contractor. We do have architecture. I will say, I wish I could get into more detail about them, but since they are a smaller arm of ours, our multifamily team, we don't get to work with them directly. For all of our larger multifamily mixed-use projects, we usually outsource an architect, so we work with other architects. But however, I am very close with some of our architecture folks here in the office, so we still are always chatting and bouncing things off of each other. And then with that, we also have a financial services team. They help us get our deal financed. They help with our partnership relations and any sort of analytical work. And then they transition to asset management for us as well. So that's a huge team that we collaborate with. And with that, I will also mention we have a tenant improvement project management team. They work more on our office projects, retail in some cases, and some independent. And then we have property management and leasing and brokerage. So very full service.
Yeah.
So I would say the ones that development touches the most is construction and financial services. Property management is separate. So just like architecture, we outsource the multifamily property management just because multifamily PM is such a beast. And our team at Styles really focuses on our retail and office assets. And then we typically, a very well-known property manager, Graystar, that's typically our go-to partner when it comes to on-site management at our projects. But going back to construction, financial services, we work with them on almost all of our deals. Construction, most of those deals with our team is within the South Florida market. We have a few projects. Sometimes we bring them up to our Northern Florida projects, but we've also worked with other contractors in the past as well. You know, when we work on wood frame or if we do projects in the Carolinas, typically sometimes we'll use local contractors, but whatever we can bring our construction group in the mix, we do. We even had them help us bid out a massive project in Nashville, Tennessee. They had some collaboration there. They're not the GC on that project, but from what I heard, they had some input. So it's just one big family. We really do work as a family. We want to support each other. We want to see every department flourish. So that collaboration is everything.
Awesome. That sounds really great. I'd be curious, that arrangement, does that eliminating the bidding process that you might find in traditional arrangement, does that accelerate the process for the overall development timeline, not having to go through those steps?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and it's a good question. I would say that it does, because one, we already have our set contracts with construction. I mean, every single time we restart one of these projects, we always go through a negotiation process with them. So it's kind of funny to be going back and forth on contracts with a group in your own company, but we certainly do that. There's always lessons learned on both sides. But having that base contract, having expectations that have already been outlined in the past, that really cuts off a good chunk of time that I would think that you would normally spend talking to several contractors, having several contractors bidding out your work. I would say reduces some of that time spent on those negotiations. They take the time to bid out the project for us. And so there's still that bidding process with subcontractors. And there's long discussions of, okay, we have to choose between three or four different subs. You know, you're not always choosing the cheapest. You're not always choosing the most expensive. So there is still definitely a bidding process that we have to go to that's very extensive. And there's positives and negatives. I feel like it's great because we're always working in each other's best interest. But you could easily say that maybe we're not getting the absolute best pricing deal if you were to bid out to three different contractors. There's also that key goal, which is we want the company to be successful. We want to work together. We want each group to be successful. And I think that there's tons of value in that. So there's lots of benefits, but I think that the benefits outweigh some of the things that are seen as more negative, but it's definitely a fun collaboration.
I could see they're still getting competitive pricing from your subs, and that's a substantial part of the overall cost.
Yes, that final number is going to be similar, I would say, to other GCs. And the thing is, if it ends up being cheaper, then you may end up paying for it on the back end, or you may end up paying for it along the way in the construction process. I feel like it always evens itself out. The price is what the price is going to be.
Exactly. And in a hot market like South Florida right now, are there bottlenecks, labor supply issues? Does having an internal development team help with some of those problems?
So, you know, I feel that I probably am not the best to really delve deep into this topic right now. But what I have heard, because we are trying to always measure our projects, the great news is I can go walk over to our pre-construction manager's office and chat with them 5 minutes. And the latest news I got was that labor is still quite high. I don't believe it's gone up too much, but the cost of labor is still quite high, at least down here in what we're seeing. I have also heard that commodity prices are maybe starting to soften a little bit. We're also trying to keep a heavy eye on concrete costs, but the overall consensus is that labor is still quite high, and that's a huge chunk of your overall cost.
Certainly. Yeah, I'm hearing that across the board. I think we're all struggling with just making projects pencil because the hard costs just keep going up and up and up, but it's harder to have the rent, the market rate stuff pencil because you have a tight ceiling here.
It's crazy. We've looked at this several times. We always compare back to our previous projects and what it costs to build the same product that we built 3 years ago. We're not even kidding. It's 50% more.
Oh my gosh.
Plus. Yeah. 50% more plus. And then when you look at rents have certainly gone up and they've stayed strong, but I mean, rents haven't gone up 50%. And I mean, I hope that they don't, because I'm
right.
Also a renter too. So it's just like,
where are you going to live? Yeah.
And like, well, no wonder nothing. Pencils costs have gone up astronomically and maybe they've stabilized. But I think the big question is, are they going to really go down enough to have to see some relief? And then with rents, it's always good to see them stay strong, but it's difficult because they just haven't kept up with the rate of costs, unfortunately.
With that, I'd love to hear about kind of any hopeful signs that you might have for us. I know it's been a really challenging 12, 18 months now. Do you have a recent project that you can share with us that you would classify as a lesson learned or a success story that you can share? That'd be great.
Yes. So hopeful signs with our group, we recently brought one of our projects out to market and it looks like hopefully, knock on wood, it's a deal that's going to transact here soon. And it's a property that, you know, I think we hoped that it would perform a little better when it came to a final sale. But at the same time, we got in with locked in with our GMP at a decent time, and we're going to do well on it. So that's always a win if you see some profit there. That's one. Lessons learned. I mean, for that project, I saw a whole chunk of the entire construction process. I was able to oversee that one in the beginning of the project when we were transitioning from building permits to putting a shovel in the ground and to capitalizing and getting a loan on that deal. I feel like during the construction, during any construction process, even if you're building the same type of design, there's always going to be lessons learned. There's definitely some things that we did very well. I would say one being, this is just a little random factoid. If you develop in Florida, you probably have heard this, but there's certain levels of radon around Florida that sometimes impacts the air quality in your units. There's nothing really in the code per se that requires developers to be cognizant of this, but it's something that we keep in mind as we build. And in this case, this particular project, we implemented in the design the capacity to add a certain fan filtration that helps purify the air in a way that will rid it of high levels of radon. And it's this natural occurring gas in the soil. It's very hard to determine whether it's going to be an issue or not until you've already built the project. And it's something to keep in mind when you have these concrete tunnel form projects that you're building as well. So long story longer, we had added this capacity in the design, a few extra dollars. And sure enough, the end of the project comes around when you're finally at a phase where you can test for it. And we did have certain levels of radon, so we had to implement the fan system, and we were able to put it in every single unit, and it turned out in our favor. It was able to work fine. But if we did not think about that ahead of time, my boss was really the individual that had put that in the design originally. If we had not done that, it would have cost us, I mean, probably hundreds of thousands of dollars to go back and put that in the design. I mean, it was still quite an investment to just go back and install these fans. So that was just one, you know, lesson learned. I mean, I think we also would have thought it would have made more sense to put some more co-working space into a few of our multifamily projects, with COVID happening, work from home being very popular, and all of our co-working offices that we put on site are quite popular. So I think seeing the rise of that, we reconsider adding a little bit more square footage when it comes to dedicating that to just a work from home space for our tenants.
No, that's great. I think we could spend a lot of time exploring. That's such a moving target right now. But last thing before we go, I did want to hear, you had mentioned some of the initiatives you're working on in South Florida, increasing opportunities for women in the development industry. I know that's a really tough. And I'd love to hear about some of the organizations you're working with that you think you have going on that front.
Yeah, so I know, Scott, we had talked a little bit about just some of my involvement. I recently become involved here in the South Florida Crew chapter. And I've also stayed heavily involved in ULI, Urban Land Institute. That's another group that also has a women's group called WLI, the Women's Leadership Initiative. And that's a group that I've done my best to step up and help where I can, plan events. And myself and another individual, we both have quite a passion for mentorship and talking with students. And so we've been working on setting up a mentorship program here with the group. It's still in the works, so you have to get some recruiting done, find some other women that have the time and have that drive as well as us to mentor and get students involved. So overall, I feel that I have a very passionate thigh when it comes to interacting with students from my university, from my previous program that I studied in. And I certainly open myself up when I have students reach out just to chat about what I do, get some advice, males and females alike. But obviously me being a female and in the industry that's still male dominated, I always loved to really take some extra time to encourage females to consider it, because it's very much a space that's open for females as is males. And it's great to see that diversity in the mix of the personalities and the different viewpoints on things. And I'm hoping that I can continue to empower young women to consider it and to know that there's very much a space for them at the table when it comes to this industry, and looking forward to seeing that evolving in the future.
Absolutely. No, that's great. No, thank you for that. And I couldn't agree more. I think that we're talking about multifamily. We're talking about maybe the most personal thing that you might have is your home. And if you have the people developing them who look like the people who live in the buildings, that's only a good thing. But
Agreed. There's lots of details.
So many. Well, oh my gosh. Thank you so much, Margo, for joining us today. I really appreciate your insights. It's been a fantastic conversation. Thanks for your time, and we'll see you on the next time. Thank you.
Oh, awesome. Thanks, Scott.